House will come to order, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, Excused, Boone, Minnis, excuse for business of the House, Nolan.
Flag salute will be led by Representative George Gilman.
Please join me. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation of God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The opening ceremony will be a moment of silence. Courtesies. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to announce that we have a visitor from my district, a special visitor today. His name is Michael Kerrigan. Michael Kerrigan is the peace organizer for Community Alliance of Lane County and recently worked with Eugene Mayor Kitty Piercy and others in promoting a resolution to end the Iraq war and bring the troops home. The resolution was recently adopted by the Eugene City Council. I would like to welcome Mr. Kerrigan.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce to the my colleagues President Fred Smith, who is here from Klamath Community College, and joining President Smith are students Anthony Bishop, Sarah Purvis, Kylie Stanley, and Anna Bloom. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do have somewhere in the gallery a very good friend, Ralph Goodwin from John Day, Oregon, and with him is Ken Olson. They're both here for Credit Union Day, but they are particularly, Ralph is a good friend and advisor. Thank you for welcoming them.
Your Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With us today is Donald Malarkey, and I believe he's up here, up above in the gallery. Donald Malarkey was born in Astoria, Oregon on July 31st, 1921. In 1939, he transferred to Astoria High School and finished his senior year before furthering his education at the University of Oregon. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Don volunteered in the parachute troops. In September of 1942, parachute troops were a new concept for the U.S. Army and U.S. Army was finding its way in developing elite units that would parachute behind enemy lines in order to achieve objectives. By the end of World War II, Donald had been promoted to the rank of tech sergeant and served more consecutive days in combat than any member of E Company 506th Parachute Infantry, Regiment 101st Airborne. Sergeant Malarkey was the recipient of the Bronze Star with Oak Leaf Cluster, Combat Infantry Badge, Presidential Citation with Oak Leaf Cluster, European, African, Mideastern Campaign Medal, American Campaign Citation, Good Conduct Medal, European Occupation Medal, World War II Victory Medal, 2 combat jumps, 4 campaign stars, along with several other foreign unit awards. Don Malarkey was discharged on November 29, 1945, and returned to Oregon. In January of 1946, Mr. Malarkey re-entered the University of Oregon, and in June 1948, he was awarded a Bachelor of Science in Business. Also in June of 1948, he married Irene Moore and moved back to Astoria, Oregon. In Astoria, Mr. Malarkey was elected to be the youngest Republican county commissioner in the state of Oregon. He's a sought-after speaker on World War II history, particularly the D-Day invasion, Operation Market Garden, the siege of Bagstone, and the drive into Germany to capture Hitler's eagle's nest. He has lectured at the United States Military Academy at West Point, the Oregon State Police Academy, and many more, including the White House. Don was recently widowed from his wife of 58 years. Don and Irene have 1 son and 3 daughters, 10 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. Please welcome Don and make him feel welcome today. Thank you.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wish to introduce 2 honorary pages that I have today. The first one is Bailey Willett. Bailey's from Sublimity. She's in 8th grade. She enjoys volleyball, swim team, and beading, and someday wants to follow Don up here into the military and be a pediatrician. The second one is Emily K. Branch. Emily is from Sublimity as well. She's in 8th grade. She enjoys sports and student council and aspires to own her own arts and crafts stores. Please bid them welcome.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'm proud to recognize a constituent of mine from Tigard, Robert Bean. I'm not sure where he is. Oh, there he is, standing. Up over there. He served in the United States Air Force from 2002 to 2006, and his wife Tina also served in the Air Force. They were married September of 2005 and then were deployed to Balad Air Force Base in Iraq in January of 2006, and he was joking to me in my office that he wouldn't recommend it as a good honeymoon spot. He served as a computer network technician, and his wife Tina, unfortunately, was injured in a mortar attack, and they've had great challenges trying to get the help and medical attention that she needs, and still working on that. But both Robert and Tina have served our country admirably, and he's here in support of House Joint Memorial 9. So please extend courtesies to Robert Bean and his wife, Tina.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And before I introduce 2 of my honored guests, I will just say that I have attended leadership discussions that Mr. Malarkey has conducted, and they're wonderful. He's also the primary incentive for the movie Band of Brothers. Today I am honored to have visiting the Capitol two very good friends and constituents. In the back gallery, we have Tom Nelson, who is the former mayor of Estacada, and he is a retired military World War II and Korea vet, and we are thankful to have you here today, Mayor Nelson. Also with him is good friend John McAdoo, who is the former assistant chief fire marshal in Estacada, and he is retired Navy, and welcome. We honor you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would ask that the House recognize and welcome one of my constituents, Mary Guidry, from Coquille. She's a freelance science writer, and she has a son who has had two tours in Iraq and is now 50% disabled. I want to recognize her and the sacrifices that her family has made. Thank you.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is my great honor to extend our courtesies to Mary Branch. She's on my left-hand side aisle. Mary Branch does not live in my district, but she lives in Representative Minnis district, but Representative Minnis could not be here today. Mary may have been in my district when I was a senator. Mary's son, Theodore Branch, is bravely serving in the U.S. Army. He's a sergeant, and he has two tours in Iraq. When he was in Iraq, he was a combat engineer, which means he is responsible to sniffing out the roadside bombs. And we appreciate that his mother and his serving, and his son, and the other branch, a sergeant, is in Fort Lewis, Washington at this time. It's my honor to extend our courtesies to you, to dear Mary. Thank you very much.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I would like to introduce to you, and I hope you'll extend courtesies to my most important constituent, my wife, Shelda Holmes. She comes from a proud military family, including her father, Mark Holmes, who served this country admirably as an infantryman in Vietnam. She's here on behalf of her family in support of House Joint Memorial 9. I'd also like to recognize my constituents, Yvonne Simmons and Dan Handelman. We thank you for being here as well.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I am privileged to introduce to you on the side gallery Shauna Hill. She's my constituent. She's the mother of a hero, Oregon hero. And his name was Private First Class Ryan Hill, and he lost his life 2 months ago. And I also want to introduce to you my constituent, Bill Coffey, who served with the invasion force to Iraq and served a second tour as well, ended just back in November. I also have from the Tehalem Chamber of Commerce, John Bridges, who will be helping us lead a rally today on the Capitol steps relating to projects of statewide significance. And you can join us out there at noon. Thanks.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming three of my constituents, Leah Bolger, Diane Safford, both are members of Veterans for Peace, and Jean Raymond from Benton County Alternatives to War, who are here in support of HJR 9. Welcome to the Capitol.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to ask you to extend courtesies to the JROTC students from North Salem High School who are here in the side aisle, and the leader of the group is Shad Certain. Thank you.
Are there further courtesies? Messages from the governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, objected by the President, informing the Senate has passed Senate Bill 553, 66, 103, 105, 501, 579, 322, 106, 112, 131, 145, 188, 195, 219, 222, 537, 206, 209, 620, 5502, 5514, 5524, 5532, and adopted SJR 21.
First reading, memorials and resolutions.
SJR 21, designating month of March in each year as Brain Injury Awareness Month.
Measure read first time. It's passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Special orders of business. Clerk will read the memorial.
HJM 9, urging President and Congress of the United States not to increase numbers of troops in Iraq and to withdraw troops from Iraq and redeploy troops no later than first quarter of fiscal year 2008.
Question now arises upon final reading and adoption of House Joint Memorial 9A. Before we begin the presentation by the carrier, I want to remind all members that following a vote, it is inappropriate to have either exclamations of support or opposition. I also want to remind all the guests in our chamber today of the same factor, that in the decorum of the House, it's inappropriate to either cheer or to express other opinions. If you wish to express those opinions following conclusion of the debate and the vote, please do carry those outside the chamber. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, on June 16, 2005, Republican Congressman Walter Jones and Ron Paul joined Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich and Neil Abercrombie in introducing House Joint Resolution 55, which they called the Homeward Bound Act. Walter Jones, as you may know, was the one who coined the term freedom fries. He is one of the most conservative members of Congress, and the Homeward Bound Act that he put together with the Democrats was a binding resolution calling for President Bush to develop a timeline and exit strategy from Iraq with a withdrawal date that would begin by October 1st, 2006. Shortly thereafter, we introduced House Joint Memorial 38 in late June of the 2005 session. It mirrored that Kucinich-Jones resolution in Congress, and we called our memorial the Oregon Homeward Bound Act. That memorial, like the one we introduced today, was intentionally crafted to avoid partisan finger-pointing and recriminations. It was simply a way to bring our troops home. It did not pass last session, and I remember hoping with all my heart that we wouldn't have to pass another resolution this session, that it wouldn't be necessary, that it wouldn't be necessary because our brave troops would be back home safe. I regret today that that is not the case. Instead, yesterday, the war entered its fifth year. So today, we bring forward another version of the Oregon Homeward Bound Act. Because I say to you this, colleagues, our troops have done their jobs, and it's long past time to bring the troops home. Here's what HJM 9 does, and I thank the good representative from Dallas for working with me to improve the memorial. The results of these improvements can be read in the HJM 9A engrossed version in your bill file. First, HJM 9 clearly lays out why the war is a shared state and federal issue. For example, my colleague from Dallas added language that notes that because of the war, the Oregon National Guard is stretched beyond the breaking point, with unit readiness to respond to an emergency or natural disaster having fallen below 40%. The amendment provided even more stark numbers about the challenges our state will face to meet the mental health and disability needs of returning veterans, particularly as programs continue to be cut at the federal level. Second, HJM 9 urges Congress to oppose the President's new Iraq War escalation plan. And third, it urges Congress and the President to set a timeline and an exit strategy from Iraq, a strategy, colleagues, that is in line with the timeline and recommendations laid out in the bipartisan Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group report. We're calling this memorial the Oregon Homeward Bound Act of 2007. And we're saying the Oregon Homeward Bound Act of 2007 is a way to bring our troops home. At the national level, we see courageous Republican senators like Chuck Hagel saying it's time to bring our troops home, that it's time to put aside any kind of differences we may have had in the run-up to the war, and it's time to stand up for our troops, and it's time to stand up for their families and say this is a way to bring our troops home. To say that it's clear that we cannot afford in either blood or treasure to provide security for Iraq forever. That we cannot ask Oregon's sons and daughters, husbands and wives, to spill their blood for Iraq's security forever. And the Homeward Bound Act is a way to bring our troops home. I am pleased that the memorial passed out of committee on a 6-1 bipartisan vote. And I was happy to work across the aisle with the good representative from Dallas to find language acceptable to both parties. Because, colleagues, I say to you this, the safety of our troops is not a partisan issue. So let's work together and pass this memorial now so we won't have to pass another Homeward Bound Act in the 2009 legislative session. Mr. Speaker, I'd now like to hand it off to my co-carrier, Representative Holvey from Eugene.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and colleagues. As one of the chief sponsors of this memorial, I am obviously speaking in support of House Joint Memorial 9. But I do so while recognizing my support and recognition of our troops. Regardless of our individual positions on the policies that have put our country in Iraq, it is important that we recognize and that we owe a great debt to our military personnel and their families who have sacrificed so much, and we should never discount or forget their sacrifice. The pain and worry a family feels while their troops are in harm's way is indescribable. And it's just really a tough thing for anybody to explain whether they agree with these policies or not. It still is just a horrible thing to go through, and I say that because I've gone through it. I'm proud of our troops and their dedication to the United States. My son is a U.S. Army Staff Sergeant who has served in Iraq, and he was awarded the Bronze Star for valor, and I am proud of him. But to know that he watched some of his comrades die in his arms bothers me sometimes, because I wonder how he will be able to live with that the rest of his life. He seems to be fine now, and he remains in the Army and is dedicated to his service. But his fiance is scheduled to return to Iraq in the next few months, and he may also return. Like so many young people that responded to our injured country after 9/11, they are serving our country for the right reasons. They perform their duties with honor and follow the orders of our country that our country gives them. Those orders reflect our policies. I disagree with those policies that have made our troops targets. Our troops should not remain as a police force in a civil war. Those policies have betrayed the loyalty and patriotism of our troops, by putting them in a war on false pretenses with no achievable mission to accomplish. We did not find Al-Qaeda or weapons of mass destruction. We did remove a dictator from power. But I worry our diplomatic efforts have left the world community with a view that we are an occupying force and not a liberating force. I believe our presence in Iraq is fomenting more violence directed at our troops. It is simply time to bring our troops home from this situation. I feel there is no way that we can end this civil war. Retired Lieutenant General Robert G. Gard recently said, "We have a social contract in this country that the military does not question the civilian control over it." But the flip side, he went on to say, is that there is an implicit assumption that they will not be put into harm's way and accept casualties except in causes that are reasonably in the national interest. In this case, he said, I can't find a rationale that makes any sense. And that is exactly how I feel about this particular war. I just don't see how we're going to improve the situation in Iraq. And I believe our soldiers have become the targets of the Islamic world now. And that is not making us safer or the world any safer. Colleagues, I implore you to support House Joint Memorial 9, the Oregon Homeward Bound Act. And please bring our troops home. We have much, much work we could do at home taking care of the people of the United States and seeing to it that our troops, our veterans, are taken care of too. But let's never forget that we still, regardless, owe our support and our gratitude for their service. I urge an aye vote on House Joint Memorial 9. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the resolution, to the memorial.
I have questions for the carrier, please.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
And yield? Good body, I tried to provide the good representative my questions ahead of time. I gave him some idea, but I'm still writing questions as we debate. So.
Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
He does.
Thank you. Honorable Representative, for clarification, are we voting on House Joint Memorial 9 amended?
Yes.
Further question of the carrier?
Additional question to carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
He does.
Honorable Representative, what is the amendment to the original bill? How was it amended? Did the amendment result from public hearings or advice from military experts, leading military or diplomatic officials, allies around the world, or the vast majority of Americans? Because I believe I heard on National Network News this morning that now some group is calling for U.S. forces to be out of Iraq by November 2008.
Mr. Speaker, I think that the person most appropriate for answering that question would be Representative Boquist, who is a former Green Beret who has served in Iraq and helped me draft the amendment. Representative Boquist, would you be willing to take that question?
Representative Boquist, do you yield?
It's a good representative, and Kurt will restate it, so I clearly understand the question.
Please restate your question.
Question is, what is the amendment to the original bill? Why was it amended? Did the amendment result from public hearings or advice from military experts, leading military diplomatic officials, allies around the world, or vast majority of Americans? Because the original bill called for the troops to be out August of 2007. However, I heard today on network news that some group is calling for forces to be out of Iraq by November 2008.
Good Representative, the answer to your question is the amendment is placed in there to adopt the Iraqi Survey Group's report. It's actually in the resolution itself. That report is a compilation of all of the input from all of the commanding generals in Iraq, senior diplomats around the world, and it calls in there for a commencement in the first quarter of 2008 of downsizing.
Another question of the carrier?
Of the carrier or of Representative Boquist?
I'm asking of the carrier.
Of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Honorable Representative, would you please clarify for us, and the decision makers will have to comply with this memorial, if the withdrawal is required by the first, if it was required by the first quarter of 2008, does that mean January the 1st of 2008, or does that mean March the 31st of 2008?
Thank you for that question, good representative from Deschutes County. Actually, what that means, federal fiscal year begins that it would begin on October 1st of 2007.
Clarification,
do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you for that clarification. But then my further question would be, does that mean October the 1st or December the 31st was the end of that quarter?
I think I would also like to extend that one to Representative Boquist, who created the amendment based on the bipartisan Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group.
Do you wish to redirect your question to Representative Boquist?
Yes, sir.
Do you yield?
I am Representative Boquist.
Yes, he does yield.
Thank you. To the good representative's question, the date insert is the first quarter of the fiscal year. The fiscal year, for those of you who don't know, begins on 1 October, and the first fiscal quarter extends from 1 October to December 31st. You'll also note in the resolution that there is a clause in there that allows Congress, of course, to approve the extension, to approve a date upon approval of Congress. So it's not necessarily a date written in stone. It's one written based on a solid exit strategy through the commanding generals and presented to Congress, as is the constitutional oversight requirement.
Other question of the carrier, Mr. Speaker?
Additional question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
The Honorable Representative from Northeast Portland, my mother-in-law's district. On the second page of the memorial, line 18 and 19, would you please provide me and my colleagues the source for that statement, most military experts?
I would. I believe that line came from multitudes of congressional testimony, and if you would like that to be expanded on, the good representative from the 23rd district, I'm sure would be happy to expound on that.
Do you wish to have that expanded on?
That's fine, Mr. Speaker. Further question of the carrier?
Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. The next two lines talk about legal experts. Could you provide us the source or the background for that reference?
Just a moment. Let me check the memorial. Mr. Speaker, I believe Representative Boquist had testified on this particular issue significantly during the committee. I would be happy to extend that question to him if you would like.
Do you wish to have that question extended?
No, that's fine, Mr. Speaker. Okay. I have a further question of the carrier.
Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Honorable Representative, please explain to this body your discussion in committee around the expanding a military mission in Iraq. At the same time, the memorial calls for the withdrawal and redeployment of U.S. forces from Iraq as soon as possible, but not later than the first quarter of fiscal year 2008.
Good representative, I wasn't in committee. I presented early on and then had to go to another committee myself.
Mr. Speaker, does some member of the committee wish to handle that question?
Is there anyone in particular you would like to ask your director question to?
Staff summary. Mr. Speaker, I have a question for Mr. Hunt, Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, do you yield to a question?
I'd be happy to. You want to restate the question?
He does. Please restate your question.
Thank you. Representative, please explain to this body the discussion and reasoning behind a memorial in front of us now that calls for a military expansion in Iraq. At the same time, the memorial calls for withdrawal and redeployment of U.S. forces from Iraq as soon as possible, but not later in the first quarter of fiscal year 2008.
Mr. Speaker, the memorial before us does not call for an expansion of troops in Iraq. In fact, it specifically takes the exact opposite position, and that was based on the committee's testimony from a whole variety of Oregonians, military, veteran, and otherwise, who came in and urged us to adopt this language.
Clarification, Mr. Speaker.
Clarification to Representative Hunt. Just a moment. Representative Hunt, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Representative, good representative. Line 38, page 2, says we resolve to expand advisory assistance to the elected government of Iraq.
Mr. Speaker, that section is very consistent with the bipartisan Iraq study group. The expanded assistance is advisory assistance to the elected government, not additional deployment of military forces put at risk in Iraq.
Clarification, Mr. Speaker.
Clarification, Representative Hunt, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Good representative, you have to have specially trained people to provide advisory assistance, so that would that not require deployment of additional troops?
Mr. Speaker, I believe when that section specifically references commencing direct regional diplomacy and advisory assistance to the elected government of Iraq, I don't see anything that would apply that to expanded deployment of our National Guard, Reserve, and active duty military personnel.
Mr. Speaker, further question of the carrier? Thank you, Representative.
Further question of the carrier? Does the carrier yield? He does.
Good representative, I think this is important because I've also read another paper that's provided to this body yesterday about military advisors, and that line 38, in my understanding, will require for additional deployment of additional trained and qualified troops. That's an important aspect of this memorial. Could you comment on that at all?
I'm not sure I understand if there's a question in there. I'd be happy to answer a question.
Do you wish to clarify your question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good representative, what I'm trying to determine, I read this in the paper that we were given on this floor yesterday, that we're going to deploy special forces into Iraq to work with the Iraqis. So I'm trying to find out how long are they going to stay there? Do they have to be out by the first quarter of fiscal year 2008?
I think if you look into the memorial, what it says is that the withdrawal will begin no later than that date.
Well, clarification, Mr. Speaker.
Clarification, does Kerry yield?
No.
He does not yield.
To the memorial, Mr. Speaker.
To the memorial.
Honorable colleagues, let me finish the rest of my questions so you understand the complexity and what you're doing here today on this floor. You're asked to vote for a memorial that's saying we want the troops out. It doesn't say all the troops. It doesn't say phased. It says we want the troops out of Iraq as soon as possible, but no later than first quarter of fiscal year 2008.
My other question would not be answered was, have we talked to our allies? Will they also withdraw? Will we tell them that we're going to be out October the 1st or December the 31st? I would have asked the carrier, did the committee discuss an addition to the memorial concerning U.S. policy should be if Iraq is attacked by one or more of its neighbors after we withdraw? Did the memorial address the redeployment of U.S. equipment and infrastructure related, and should we deploy, and what would be the cost of bringing that stuff, the equipment and infrastructure out? Also, did the memorial drafters in their discussions consider how long it took the United States to withdraw its forces from Japan and Germany after World War II? Those were the questions that I would have asked the carrier if he would have agreed to accept my questions. Honorable colleagues, this memorial gives me much discomfort, which I hope you'll understand and respect. I've lost sleep. I've sought legal advice. I've sought advice of leaders of this chamber. What can I do? I do not rise to debate the merits of this issue, which the memorial resolves. I do think I have the military education, training, and expertise to debate anyone in this House on this memorial, the issues in this memorial. I served for 10 years at the highest level of the Department of Defense. Now, I'm not telling you I was a policymaker, a decision maker. I was a staff officer. But I did gain much insight and knowledge about how policy and decisions are made at the executive branch, the State Department, and the Defense Department. I served from June 1990 until October 1992 as a senior military officer in Yugoslavia during the beginning of that country's civil wars. Yugoslavia's civil wars have some commonality with Iraq. They have different religious factions, and there were insurgencies in that conflict just like there are in Iraq. However, I do not rise to debate the issues in the memorial. Although I oppose the memorial, I respect the right of those who support the memorial. That is your right, and I respect your right to disagree with me about issuing this memorial and expressing your opinion. My problem, colleagues, is that if a majority of the representatives present today vote yes, and I understand that could be 21 of us, because we only need a quorum, it's a memorial, you don't need 31. 21 of us could vote yes. It will pass and be made part of the official part of the history of this body. The press will report it. Men and women serving in harm's way will read that the Oregon legislature passed a memorial on Iraq, which I do not support. However, the memorial will not state that all members of this great body support the memorial. I've been advised, don't worry about that. People will understand that everyone did not vote yes. However, the memorial so states that the members of this Oregon 74th legislative session, which I'm a member of, resolved this and resolved that. I wanted to find some way where you who support this resolution get to express your opinion, but those who do not support it have the right to be separated from this memorial by stating a majority of the 74th legislative session resolved, da-da-da. I guess my wish will not be granted. You know, honorable colleagues, let me apologize to you. I've been talking about me and how I do not want to be attached to this memorial.
Representative Butler yields.
Thank you, Representative. I do not want to be attached to this memorial as a supporter because I am a member of the 74th legislative session. My wife's not here today. She would probably say, Gene, it's not all about you. I oppose this memorial because it's not about you or me and our desire to express our individual opinion. I urge you, I beg you to oppose this memorial due to my belief from personal experience that this memorial will adversely affect the morale and attitude of the 130,000 plus men and women who are serving this great nation in harm's way as volunteers. That's my opinion. This war is different than the one in which I served. In Vietnam, almost all of the military was drafted to serve. That's not the case in Iraq. They're volunteers. As a 24-year-old first lieutenant, I commanded a unit of 60 men. I had to send some of these men into harm's way flying on combat missions almost every day. I flew some of these missions. Thank God none of my personnel were killed or wounded. Many of you in this chamber today were too young to be politically involved in the Vietnam War. However, I assure you that the political opposition and the civilian opposition to the war did have a tremendous adverse impact on the morale of the airmen whom I commanded. I know from experience that this type of action will adversely affect the morale and attitude of those brave men and women serving in nation's harm way. I experienced this firsthand while serving in harm's way. The morale of the military members serving in Iraq is one reason to vote no on this resolution. The second reasons you should vote no are Lance Corporal Nathan D. Windsor, 20, from Newport, killed in combat in Iraq, March 2007, survived by his father, mother, stepfather, and his younger brother. Sergeant First Class John S. Stevens, 43, from Prineville and LeGrand, killed in combat in Iraq in March 2007, survived by his wife, three children, and two grandchildren. Sergeant Long N. Nguyen, 27, from Portland, killed February the 10th, 2007, in Afghanistan, survived by parents and two brothers and a sister. Sergeant Long N. Nguyen, 27, died February the 10th in Afghanistan, hometown Portland, Oregon, two brothers and a sister. Private First Class Brian A. Browning, age 20, died February the 6th in Iraq, hometown Astoria, Oregon. Private First Class Ryan J. Hill, age 20, died January the 20th in Iraq, hometown Kaiser, Oregon. Army Sergeant Sean P. Finley, 25, died January the 20th in Iraq, hometown Portland, Oregon. Army Sergeant Bernard C. Gibson, 26, died December the 10th, 2006 in Iraq, hometown Tualatin, Oregon. Corporal Billy B. Ferris, age 20, died December the 3rd in Iraq. He was a student in Salem, Oregon. Specialist Douglas C. Desjardins, age 24, died November the 5th in Iraq. United States Army Private First Class Dean R. Bright, age 32, October the 4th, 2006, died in Iraq, Roseburg, Oregon. United States Marine Corporal Derek W. Jones, age 21, died October the 8th, 2006, in Iraq, hometown Salem, Oregon. United States Army Corporal Chase A. Haig, age 22, died October the 1st, 2006, in Iraq, hometown Portland.
Representative, I've been asked or reminded by the parliamentarian that we have the responsibility to have our remarks germane to the contents of the bill, and that if you have information that these folks support the memorial one direction or the other, that might be appropriate, but otherwise the list might not be germane to the conversation.
Mr. Speaker, I hope the parliamentarian and everyone have been listening to my presentation. These are the reasons for this vote. That supports my entire argument.
Please stand at ease. Representative, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Flores yields.
United States Army Sergeant Nathan B. Lindsay, age 38, died September 9, 2006, Afghanistan, home, Troutdale, Oregon. United States Army Staff Sergeant Robert J. Paul, age 43, died September 8, 2006, Afghanistan, from the Dalles. United States Army Sergeant, First Class, Richard J. Hinkles, the second, age 32, died September the 3rd in Iraq, hometown Woodburn, Oregon. United States Marine Lance Corporal Randy L. Newman, age 21, died August the 20th in Iraq, hometown Bend, Oregon. United States Army Private Joseph R. Blake, age 34, August 17, 2006, Afghanistan, hometown, Portland, Oregon. United States Navy Petty Officer, Second Class, Mark A. Lee, age 28, died August 2nd in Iraq, hometown, Hood River. United States Marine Captain Christopher T. Pate, age 29, died July the 21st in Iraq, hometown, Portland, Oregon. United States Staff Sergeant Jason M. Every, age 29, died July 16, 2006, in Iraq, attended Corvallis High School. United States Army Specialist Robert L. Jones, age 22, died June 17, Milwaukee, Oregon. United States Army Private First Class Thomas L. Tucker, age 25, died June 16, 2006, in Iraq, Madras, Oregon. United States Army Specialist Jeremy M. Lovelace, age 25, died May 29, 2006 in Iraq, hometown Escondida, Oregon. United States Petty Officer, Third Class Marcus J. Needles, age 22, died April 2, 2006 in Iraq, hometown Beaverton, Oregon, survived by his wife Christine Mullen. United States Army Specialist Ryan Doran Walker, age 25, January the 5th, 2006, in Iraq, hometown Pendleton, Oregon, survived by father Randy Walker, mother Louise Walker. United States Army Staff Sergeant Michael S. Zulan, age 32, December 13th, 2005, in Iraq, hometown Elgin, Oregon. Survivors include his wife, Teresa, stepdaughter Emily, 8, son Mikey, 6, parents Dennis and Irene Hogan. United States Lance Corporal John M. Holmeson, age 20, December the 1st, 2005, died in Iraq from Scappoose. United States Army Sergeant William Muswin, age 24, died November 23rd in Iraq, hometown Hillsboro. United States Marine Lance Corporal Tyler Toller, died in Iraq November 19, 2005 from Tangent, Oregon. United States Army Specialist Vernon Widener, age 34, died November 23, 2005 in Iraq, survived by two young sons. Oregon National Guard Warrant Officer Adrian B. Stump, age 22, died September 25, 2005, in Afghanistan from Pendleton, Oregon. Oregon National Guard Sergeant Tane Braun, age 30, died September 25, 2005, in Afghanistan, hometown Pendleton. United States Navy Petty Officer First Class Jeffrey A. Lucas, age 36, died June 28, 2005 in Afghanistan, Corbett, Oregon, survived by his wife Rhonda, his son, his parents, and brother. Oregon National Guard Sergeant John B. Ogburn III, age 45, died May the 22nd in Iraq, hometown is in Idaho, but he works for the Oregon Corrections Facility at Snake River, and he attended the University of Oregon. United States Army Sergeant Jacob Simpson, age 24, died May the 16th, 2005 in Iraq, hometown Ashland, Oregon. United States Army PFC Specialist Ricky W. Rockholt, Jr., age 28, died April 28, 2005 in Iraq, hometown Winston, Oregon, survived by wife of 4 months and a brother. United States Navy Hospital Man Aaron A. Kent, age 28, died April 23, 2005 in Iraq, hometown Portland, Oregon.
United States Army Crummel yields.
Thank you, Representative. United States Army Private First Class Kevin S.K. Wetzel, age 20, died April 19th in Iraq from Newport, Oregon. Honorable colleagues, these are men. These are their lives that have been given for the ultimate cause. United States Army Major Stephen W. Thornton, age 46, died April 18, 2005 from Springfield, Oregon, survived by wife Brenda, 3 children, and 5 grandchildren. Oregon National Guard Staff Sergeant Kevin D. Davis, age 41, died April the 4th in Iraq, hometown Lebanon, Oregon, survived by his wife, son, and 2 daughters. United States Army Sergeant Adam J. Pumador, age 22, died February the 16th in Iraq from Gresham, Oregon. Oregon National Guard Sergeant First Class Mark C. Warren, age 44, died January 31st, 2005 in Iraq, hometown LeGrand, Oregon. Survived by 3 sons. United States Army First Lieutenant Nainam Ho, age 27, died in Iraq January 27, 2005. He is attended, his wife lives in Newburgh, Oregon. United States Marine Corporal James Lee Moore, age 24, died in Iraq January 26, 2005, hometown Roseburg, Oregon. Washington National Guard Sergeant Damon Fickey, age 26, died December 30, 2004 in Iraq. He graduated from Beaverton High School, survived by his wife, Talia. United States Army Specialist Edwin Roadhouse, age 36, December the 5th, 2004 in Iraq, died. Lived in McMinnville, Oregon. United States Army Sergeant David A. Mitz, age 24, died in defense of his country December the 4th, 2004 in Iraq from Hammond, Oregon. United States Army Specialist Jeremy E. Christensen, age 27, died November the 27th, 2004 in Iraq. He attended Centennial and Sam Barlow High Schools in Portland. Oregon National Guard Sergeant David W. Johnson, age 37.
How dare you use the name of someone you don't know to justify your political agenda here? The family of the...
It's inappropriate to interrupt the floor or have expressions from the gallery. Please keep your comments to yourself or go outside the building, please. Thank you. Representative, please continue.
Thank you. I apologize to the lady. United States Marine Lance Corporal Aaron Bowles, age 24, September the 24th, 2004 in Iraq, hometown Hood River, Oregon, survived by his wife, unborn child, and son. Oregon National Guard Sergeant David J. Weisenberg, age 26, September the 13th, 2004 in Iraq, hometown Portland, Oregon. Army National Guard Sergeant Benjamin Eisenberg, age 27, September the 13th, 2004, in Iraq, Sheridan, Oregon. Oregon National Guard Specialist Class Ken Liston, age 20, died July the 28th, 2004, in Iraq, attended Forest Grove High School. United States Marine Corporal Brian Kelly, age 21, died July 16, 2004, in Iraq, from Klamath Falls, survived by fiancé. United States Lance Corporal James Houston, Jr., age 22, died July 2, 2004, in Iraq, from Hermiston. Army National Guard Specialist Eric McKinley, age 24, died June 18, 2004, in Iraq, from Corvallis. Army National Guard Sergeant Justin Elry, age 23, June 4, 2004, in Iraq. He was killed, and he's from Salem, Oregon. Army National Guard Specialist Justin Linden, age 22, killed in Iraq, June 4, 2004, hometown Portland, Oregon, survived by his wife. Army National Guard First Lieutenant Eric McKay, age 25, he died in Iraq, June 4, 2004. He's from LeGrand and survived by a wife. United States Army Reserve Specialist Joseph Jeffries, age 21, killed in Afghanistan May the 29th, 2004, hometown Beaverton, Oregon, survived by a wife and an unborn child. United States Lance Corporal Bob Roberts, age 30, died in Iraq May the 17th, 2004. He attended high school in Portland. United States Marine Lance Corporal Gary Van Leuven, age 20, died in Iraq April 17, 2004, survived by his fiancée, Jacqueline. United States Army Specialist Chase Whitham, age 21, died in Iraq May the 8th, 2004, hometown Eugene, Oregon.
Representative Morgan yields.
Thank you, Representative. United States Army Specialist Philip Rogers, age 23, died April the 4th, 2004, in Iraq, attended Gresham High School. United States Army Private First Class William Ramers, age 19, died February the 19th, 2004, in Iraq, from Portland, Oregon. United States Army Sergeant Travis Mothart, age 23, died January 27, 2004, in Iraq, Brownsville, Oregon, survived by a son. Sergeant Major Eric F. Cook, age 43, killed in Iraq December the 24th, 2003. Mother lives near Malala. Oregon National Guard Specialist Nathan Nakis, age 19, killed in Iraq December the 16th, 2003, attended OSU. United States Army Specialist Christopher Wesley, age 26, December 8, 2003, killed in Iraq, attended Beaverton High School. United States Army Specialist Joseph Bickerstaff, age 23, died December 8, 2003, in Iraq, from Corvallis, survived by a wife. United States Army Chief Warrant Officer Eric Kesterson, age 29, died November 15, 2003, in Iraq, hometown Verona, Oregon. Army Staff Sergeant David S. Perry, age 36, killed in Iraq August the 10th, 2003. His parents live in Bend, and he survived by his parents, wife, and three children. Army Staff Sergeant Christopher R. Willoughby, age 29, died July the 20th, 2003. His mother lives in Oregon. He survived by a wife and two sons. United States Marine Corporal Travis Burdock Nall, age 21, killed in Iraq July the 2nd, 2003, hometown Portland, Oregon. United States Navy Hospitalman Joshua McIntosh, age 22, killed June 26, 2003. United States Army Staff Sergeant Robert Stever, age 36, died April the 8th, 2003, in Iraq, hometown Pendleton, Oregon, survived by his wife Cindy and one daughter. United States Marine Captain Aaron Carias, age 31, killed in Iraq March 30, 2003, from Sherwood, Oregon, survived by a wife and three children. Air Force Major Gregory L. Stone, age 40, killed in March 25, 2003. He attended OSU. Second Lieutenant Frederick E. Pokerny, Jr., age 31, killed in Iraq March 23, 2003, attended OSU, survived by a wife, a daughter, and a sister. United States Army Sergeant Donald Walters, 33, died March 23, 2003 in Iraq. Hometown Salem, Oregon, survived by his wife, Stacy, and three daughters. United States Army Reserve Specialist Brandon Tobler, age 19, died March 22, 2003 in Iraq, attended Franklin High School in Portland. Brandon sent his parents an email before he passed away, before he was killed. It read, "I feel that I can make a difference out here. Then I've done my part. If I can save one life, if I can do something that makes a family sleep easier at night without fear, then I've done my purpose." United States Lance Corporal Brian Bertrand, age 23, died January 9, 2002 in Pakistan from Coos Bay, Oregon. Honorable colleagues, you have on your desk the photo of three or four Oregonians who made the ultimate sacrifice. One of those is U.S. Marine Lance Corporal Randy L. Newman from my district. Representative Burley and I attended the memorial for Randy. Later, Chuck and I attended a veterans event in Bend with Randy's parents and family. They are still suffering the pain from their loss. Please do not dishonor their son and their memory by passing this memorial. I overheard some colleagues yesterday saying they had not read the memorial. This is too important a vote to not know what you're voting about and how it will affect 130,082 of our next great generation. This vote is too important for you not to read the memorial, study it, think about it before you vote. I have given you 130,082 of the strongest reasons to vote no on this resolution or send it back to the committee. Then each of you, individually, tell your congressman, tell the president what you think. But please look again at the photo of Randy Newman and think about these 130,082 names.
Representative, you're out of time. Do we have someone who wishes to yield? Representative Hannah yields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Please think about these people, these two reasons that I gave you, morale and the people that made the ultimate sacrifice. If every one of you, everyone in the balcony, every one of you have your right to disagree, but don't take my right away. Express your right to do that as individuals. Thank you.
Further discussion? Excuse me, madam. Please take your comments outside. Nice. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Speaker, to the resolution and request to use the Veterans Visual Aid.
To the joint memorial, yes.
Colleagues, let me start off by dispelling several myths I've heard today, I've heard over the last week, and I've heard the last couple months, and I don't think my door has been closed to any one of you. First myth. War is not a political issue. Politicians should stay out of the way. The academic and historical fact is war is, in fact, an extension of politics. Every single general in the United States is a political appointee approved by the United States Senate. And our own generals have clearly stated in the congressional record there must be a political solution. Next myth. This is not a state issue. The United States Constitution, which everybody here swore to defend and uphold in this chamber, lays out delegated, implied, and concurrent powers. Oregon constitutionally shares responsibility for the Oregon National Guard. Oregon shares $12 billion in federal state programs under the concurrent powers. I'm more than willing to send the $9 billion they provide back, but I haven't seen this chamber yet willing to do so. If you don't believe what I have to say, then read the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Next myth. This is a partisan attack on the president in an effort to discredit Republicans. Folks, you should have on your desk an article I wrote in 2002 opposing the ground war. yet supporting the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. I quote from page 2 that is on your desk, "War is not a partisan issue. It's an ugly affair in which old men send young men to die for their country." I've sent Democrats, Republicans, blacks, whites, and Hispanics to die for this country in places like Iraq, Sudan, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and elsewhere. War is not a partisan issue. Next, Congress must support the commander-in-chief and has no right to oppose him. Frankly, this is the biggest line of hogwash that I've heard from the first days of the Continental Congress. The first days in 1775, before a constitution, Congress set the rules, not the commanding general and not President Hamilton. From the 17th day of September, 1787, until today, and I don't think we suspended the Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war, grant letters of marque, and I know for a fact I'm the only member of this chamber or sitting in this room that's ever seen a letter of marque, and Congress has the powers, I quote, to make rules concerning capture on land and water. I'm the first one to tell you, as a Republican, I'm not real happy about the makeup of the federal Congress. But it's their constitutional authority that's not debatable. The American people elected them, and they represent the majority today. And again, let me make it clear, and I quote right out of the United States Constitution, there is no higher legal authority. We don't need the counselors in the chamber. Congress reserves solely to Congress the ability, quote, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for more than 2 years. It's the balance of power applied to war in the Constitution. If you don't like the balance of power between the executive and the legislative branch, you're in the wrong chamber. I know for a fact today that none of us blindly follow the president. And a second fact is none of us will blindly follow the governor. Not in either party. Next myth. We need to follow the advice of our military commanders. I've been there. I totally agree with this one. But this argument really mystifies me. It makes me wonder, are we analytical and do we really know the truth? I've served under 6 presidents from Ford to Bush 2. During the Clinton administration, I stood up publicly, and I'm guilty of saying the president should follow the advice of his military commanders, and I know a third of us have done that too. I'd be a hypocrite if I suddenly said something different. Now's the rub, folks. I've heard hundreds of people say we support the commanders in Iraq, so we need more troops. I'm dumbfounded.
Representative Riley yields.
This question came up earlier. Again, I'm dumbfounded. Did General Abizay, the commander of Central Command, ask for 8 more brigades? No. Check the congressional record. Check the facts. Did General Casey, the senior ground commander on the ground, ask for 5 or 8 additional brigades? No, and in fact, he's publicly stating so yesterday. It's in the congressional record. Lieutenant General Petraeus, the new commander, has publicly said, we have a 1 in 4 chance of success. Now, let me restate that. The senior commander says we have a 75% chance of failure in the surge. Next myth. Passing a resolution or talking publicly hurts the morale of troops. I respectfully disagree with the good colonel. Morale in a combat unit is a function of leadership, esprit de corps, and field support. If a company, battalion, or division commander is suffering right along with his troops but still looking out for the welfare, morale is generally pretty good in the unit. Keep in mind, as I said, the commanding general has said the mission only has a 75% chance of success. I don't need to give you the BS word that most of the troops are saying. Men and women in combat are a band of brothers. They live, fight, and support each other. They are not swayed by newspaper reports or patriotic rhetoric. Soldiers know it is a line of crap when their buddies get arrested for mistakenly wounding a civilian in the middle of a firefight, and the rules of engagement from Washington, D.C. require pictures and two sworn statements. Let me say that again. The rules of engagement require pictures and two sworn statements to detain an insurgent who just killed their buddy. Soldiers are less interested in moral support in the combat zone than real support. Is there hot chow? Is there cold drink? Is there enough ammunition? Did they get vehicles, helicopter support, body armor, parts for their equipment? That's his way to destroy morale, is to see some fat contractor getting rich in the green zone while soldiers fight and die in squalor. Now, our hired mercenaries can have a cold beer, but our soldiers can't. We need to support our troops. There's 60 members in this chamber. Every single member supports the troops. The key point here is when you're sending men and women to die, there's no room for emotion. The mission must be well-defined and have a reasonable chance of success. I ask you right now to look at the Newsweek on your desk. What sort of country sends a 20-year-old woman to war to have both legs blown off and then sticks them in a cockroach-infested hospital? I'm not interested in excuses. We've been at this 4 years, and all 60 members of this chamber have had an opportunity to support our troops. And to two of them, chairs of the last session's Veterans Committee and this one, they have done an exceptional job of fighting the states and the feds to support our deploying troops and our veterans. Next myth. We have a clearly defined mission with an exit strategy. Clear, hold, and rebuild is not a well-defined mission or an exit strategy. Clear, hold, and rebuild is nothing more than political spin. There was a clearly defined mission in 2004, 2005, and 2006. The argument in the presidential campaign is both candidates clearly defined the mission was to train the Iraqi military and police to defend themselves and their country. The fact of the matter is that mission has failed to date. It's in the Hamilton-Baker report. That report had input from every single commanding general in the theater. The present commander in Iraq says we need to train the Iraqis. The present commander says we need to get closer to the Iraqi people. He has a decent plan. So are we doubling the number of advisors, which actually reduces troop strength? No. Are we sending light infantry in to work with the local Iraqi population and communities? No. We're sending five brigades of armor comprised of tanks and fighting vehicles made for open desert warfare. Let me say that again. We're sending 50-ton tanks to hug children and rebuild schools as part of the clear hold and rebuild. Those armored vehicles won't even fit down the side streets of Baghdad because the streets are too narrow. The resolution asks for common sense, nothing else. Don't let emotions overcome the simple facts. In closing, let me sure we all understand those facts. Not a single Iraqi flew into the World Trade Center.
Representative Gelser yields.
Not a single Shiite flew into the World Trade Center that I'm aware of. In fact, 14 Saudis flew into the World Trade Center, but we haven't done anything about that. My point is simple. 2001, there were 62 countries listed as possible terrorist threats to the United States of America. We're dealing with three. Afghanistan, Iraq, and if you don't know, Somalia. We got 59 to go. The military's exhausted. We've heard the list of the dead. Our generals have clearly said we need a better plan, and I agree. Now, for those of you who think that I've gone soft, unlike the president who wants to bring terrorists to justice, I'm not interested in bringing a single terrorist to justice. I want them tracked down and killed. A bullet put between their eyes. We're wasting time. We're wasting resources in Iraq. It's time to bring most of the troops home, send in the advisors, give General Petraeus the infantry he wants, and give the fighting troops what they need, not what a bunch of rich friends of politicians want them to have. It's time to track down those responsible for 9/11 and kill them. My message is simple. Vote on the facts. don't vote on emotions. My district overwhelmingly supports this resolution, and I'll vote with my district. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the memorial.
To the memorial.
Colleagues, I rise today in support of House Joint Memorial 9, and I do so with a heavy heart, because today is a day that I hoped would never come here 4 years after the beginning of this war in Iraq. And yet here we are, still standing today in the same conflict, in the same sacrifice, in the same loss of life. When this memorial was drafted, the number that was mentioned was over 3,100 had lost their lives. Now that number is over 3,200. 79 Oregonians, now we're talking about 82 Oregonians. And who did not have tears in their eyes as they heard the names of those Oregonians who had paid the ultimate price? But colleagues, I ask you, how many more names need to be added to that list before we bring an end to this? The sacrifice that's being paid in lives, not to mention the injured and the Iraqis, too, who are paying an even more enormous toll in loss of life. These are the sacrifices. But for those who say that this is not our issue and we do not have a right to speak out, I would say to you that we are supporting this war. This year alone, Oregonians have put over $1 billion of their tax dollars toward the war in Iraq. And when you think of the things that we have been discussing here the last 2 months, the needs that we have in our state, the priorities that Oregonians have, are each one of us is paying a price for the conflict and these tax dollars. Congress controls the purse strings for our military, but ultimately the American people are controlling the course of the conversation about Iraq. Today, they and Oregonians want us to send the message to Congress that our federal government needs to get its priorities in line with the people's. And there's another reason why we need to speak out today. The men and women who are going to Iraq are the very people that we need here in our state to protect Oregonians. Every time we redeploy the reserves and guards, we are losing out on another year of their invaluable service to the public safety and economy of our communities. We need these firefighters, police officers, teachers, and healthcare workers here at home. The men and women who are putting themselves on the line in Iraq leave behind families, and they deserve our very best. But they are the same families who are hurt when budgets for social services and schools fall short. Their families are working families, and they are the backbone of Oregon. And make no mistake about who is paying the price for this war. This is a working families war. As the good representative from rural Deschutes County spoke of earlier, we do not have a draft. We do not have a lottery system. And it is the sons and daughters of working families who are fighting and who are dying. The service members and reservists serving in Iraq are disproportionately blue-collar. They are our fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters. No one decides to join the military without a strong sense of duty to their country. But for many, that sense of duty is supplemented by the need for extra income, the desire for more education, or even a longing to be part of something greater than themselves. For this reason, the roster of Americans killed in Iraq looks a great deal like the American working class itself, racially and ethnically diverse, made up of men and women working to build better lives for themselves and their families. Colleagues, a few months ago in September, I talked to a mother whose son is in the Marines and who was serving in Iraq. And she told me of how painful it is for her to watch on television or follow the news on the internet and hear of yet another conflict that results in fatalities in the area where her son is serving. And she told me of how her heart stops until her phone rings or she gets an email saying that her son is all right
And then she rushes to her husband, and they hug each other in relief, until her very next thought is that that was some other mother's son or daughter. And she cannot rejoice, and she feels that grief. So, colleagues, today I would ask you to join me.
Representative Cannon yields.
Thank you, Representative. I ask you to join me in supporting the Oregon Homeward Bound Act to honor those young men and women who have paid the ultimate price and those who are still serving. By bringing them home, by putting an end to this, colleagues, please join me in voting yes.
Further discussion, Representative Nelson.
In the last, to the bill, or
to the memorial.
Memorial. In the last legislature, I was so incredibly proud. It's my belief that we did more for our veterans and our troops and their families than had ever been done in the history of this legislature in 146 years. Well, I know the words of what we did got to our troops, because I cannot tell you how many, many, many thank yous I've gotten for what you all did. Incredible appreciation. And not just from those just coming home, but from long-term veterans who really realize how wonderful it was and really is that this legislature supported our veterans and their families, our troops and their families. My question regarding House Joint Memorial 9 is, are we giving the same positive moral support to our troops and their families as we did in the last legislature? America's military can win wars. We've done it in the past, and I have absolute confidence that we'll continue to do it in the future. We've won fights in which we possessed overwhelming technological superiority, like in Desert Storm, as well as conflicts in which we were the technical underdogs, like the American Revolution. We've crossed swords with numerically superior foes and with militaries a fraction of the size of our own. We've battled on our own soil and on the soil of foreign lands, on the sea, under the sea, and in the skies. We've even engaged in a bit of cyber combat way out there on the electronic frontier. At one time or another, we've done battle under just about every circumstance imaginable, armed with everything from muskets to cruise missiles. And we've managed to do it all with the wrong army. That's right. We have the wrong army. It's too small. It's not deployed properly. It's inadequately trained. And it doesn't have the right sort of logistical support. It's a shambles. The reason I know that is because the critics and the media have told me so. We also have the wrong Navy. We've got the wrong Air Force, the wrong Marine Corps, and the wrong Coast Guard. Just pick up a newspaper or turn on your television. In the past week, I've watched or read at least a dozen commentaries on the strength, size, and deployment of our military forces. All of our uniform services get called on the carpet for different reasons, but our critics and our media unanimously agree that we're doing pretty much everything wrong. It's sort of a game. The critics won't tell you what the game's called, so we'll just call it the No Right Answer Game. Here's rule one. No matter how the U.S. military is organized, it's the wrong force. Actually, that's the only real rule in the game. We don't really need any other rules because that one applies in all possible situations. If the Air Force's fighter jets are showing their age, critics tell us that Air Force leaders are mismanaging their assets and endangering the safety of their personnel. If the Air Force attempts to procure new fighter jets, they're shopping for toys, and that money could be spent better elsewhere. Getting the hang of the game? It's easy. Keeping old planes is the wrong answer. But getting new planes is also the wrong answer. There's no right answer, not ever.
Representative, you're out of time. Representative Maurer yields.
Thank you. There's no right answer, not ever. Just ask the media. It works everywhere. When the Army's small, it's too small. Then we start to hear phrases like overextended or spread too thin, and the integrity of our national defense is called into question. When the Army's large, it's too large, and it's an unnecessary drain on our economy. Terms like dead weight and dead wood get thrown around. We could build a medium-sized army, and everyone would be happy. A medium-sized army is too small to deal with large-scale conflicts and too large to keep military spending properly muzzled. The naysayers will attack any middle-of-the-road solution anyway on the grounds that it lacks a coherent strategy. So small is wrong, large is wrong, and medium-sized is also wrong. Now, we're beginning to understand the game. No branch of the military is exempt. When the Navy builds aircraft carriers, we're told that we really need small, fast, multipurpose ships. If we centralize our military infrastructure, the experts tell us that we are vulnerable to attack. We're inviting another Pearl Harbor. If we decentralize our infrastructure, we're sloppy and overbuilt, and the BRAC experts break out their calculators like they did for Portland and start dismantling what they call our excess physical capacity. If we leave our infrastructure unchanged, we're accused of becoming stagnant in a dynamic world environment. Even the lessons of history are not sacrosanct. When we learn from the mistakes we made in past wars, we're accused of failing to adapt to emerging realities. When we shift our eyes toward the future, the critics quickly tell us that we've forgotten our history and we're therefore doomed to repeat it. If we somehow manage to assimilate both past lessons and emerging threats, we're informed that we lack focus. Where does it come from, this default assumption that we're doing the wrong thing no matter what we happen to be doing? How did our military wind up in a zero-sum game? We can prevail on the field of battle, but we can't win a war of words, where the overriding assumption is that we're always in the wrong. Can you think of a single point in history where our forces were of the correct size, the correct composition, correctly deployed, and appropriately trained all at the same time? Pick a war, any war. For that matter, we could pick any period of peace. Then we could dig up as many official and unofficial historical documents, reports, reconstructions, and commentaries as we could. And for every unbiased account we uncover, we'll find three commentaries by revisionist historians who cannot wait to tell you how badly the U.S. military bungle things. We have one defense against House Joint Memorial 9. What we're doing in this legislature today. And that is success. When we fight, we win. And that's got to count for something. Let's let our troops, our families, hear us say that. When we fight, we win. Isn't that a more positive position for us to take?
Further discussion, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the memorial.
To the memorial.
My friends, be very careful. Please be very, very careful. This vote will have national, even international consequences. Ironic when you consider that HJM 9 will change no law in Oregon, nor will it even slightly change the course of action of the United States. But it will do something very big. It will demonstrate to our enemies that they are one step closer to breaking the will and the resolve of the American people. It will demonstrate to our enemies that they are one step closer to defeating America the only way they can. Not in battle, not in the streets, not even through terrorism, but by dividing we Americans against ourselves. The greatest American told us that a house divided against itself cannot stand. During our country's darkest days, he also asked this: shall we expect some transatlantic giant to crush us? Never. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? I answer, it must spring up amongst us, wrote President Lincoln. If destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its author. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. Today, there are some who oppose this war because they choose domestic political interests over national security interests. Others oppose this war because of simple, visceral contempt for a president and what they feel he represents. This has been termed the war against the war on terrorism. I'm confident that none in this chamber are so motivated. I know that most who oppose this war do so for true, heartfelt conviction, and for that I salute you. And I believe that each of us in public life has not only the opportunity, but the responsibility to publicly voice our views on large issues, town halls, op-eds, and so forth. But there is an important distinction between individual advocacy on one hand and formally positioning this House of Representatives and the people of Oregon on another. Formally positioning our state and her people to a memorial that will have no practical effect other than providing aid and comfort to our enemies. Now, no, come on, Scott, that's not what we're doing. We don't support aid. I can hear it now. We don't support aid and comfort to our enemies. We do this to protest wrong-headed U.S. policy and to protect our fine young men and women in uniform. Well, Mr. Speaker, I suggest, as it's been said, that there is only one sure way to protect our troops, only one sure way to have peace, and we can have it today, right now. Surrender. Surrender and bring them all home. Iraq, Afghanistan, the Sinai, Germany, South Korea, and 100 other points around the globe. But if surrender is not an option, Mr. Speaker, then the only real option is victory. There is no middle path. This war is horrible, often poorly managed. It is hard beyond description to lose young Americans. We hope, we grieve, and we pray every day for our brave soldiers. Just a week ago Friday, I was jogging through Reed College in Portland, and I saw the thousands and thousands of small planted flags representing the American and the Iraqi war dead. These are the times that try men's souls, wrote Thomas Paine. So why continue? Why fight? Why not vote yes today?
because in doing so, we tell our enemies that there is a limit to our resolve. We tell those who call America the Great Satan, those who use terror and intolerance to spread radical Islamism, those who would destroy Western civilization, and those who are opposed to our every founding value of nature's God and liberty, justice and equality, we tell them that there is a point at which we will go no further. We tell them there is a price we will not pay. Imagine, friends, America removed from the Middle East with no influence, no leverage. Imagine as Iraq crumbles, Al-Qaeda and jihadists ascendant, and in Iran with no practical restraints of American presence or American resolve. Imagine Iran then developing its nuclear weapons, led by a sociopath who believes himself the righteous vanguard of God on earth. Imagine the conflagration as Turkey, Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia all race to achieve nuclear parity. A citizen once said that we are at war with the most dangerous enemy ever faced by mankind. And if we lose this war, and in so doing lose our way of freedom...
Representative Dalum yields.
Thank you, Representative Dalum. If we lose this war, and in so doing lose our way of freedom, history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Let that not be our epitaph. My friends, anxiety and self-doubt are as common during war as is complacency during peace. In every war, from the Revolution to the Civil War, from the World Wars to the Cold War, we have struggled with questions of cost and purpose. This truly is a credit to the nobility of democracy. So ask the questions, demand the answers, but then remember Thomas Paine's final observation when he said, "The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands now deserves thanks. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation. The harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." Colleagues, hold fast. Reject this memorial. Give our enemies no comfort, no quarter. And remember that in the final analysis, it's not about America right or wrong. It's about America, period. What's right is everywhere. It's you, it's your families, it's your neighborhoods, it's this house, it's this state. And what's wrong? Well, what's wrong, we take care of. With grace, we stand strong and united, we find moral stamina, we say let's roll, and we take care of it just as we Americans always have. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, to the memorial.
To the memorial.
Colleagues, this has probably been the most difficult situation I've ever been in since I've been in the House or since I've been an elected official. I'm torn between several aspects of this. First of all, I'm not a general. Second of all, I've never been to the Middle East. And third of all, I don't even know what I don't even know with what's going on there. I only make my observations by what I learn. This is a bad war. But could someone tell me what a good war is? There's death, dismemberment, and a lot of innocent people die. There's no glory in it. The military itself are the ones that are adamantly against war, because they're the ones that are maimed. They're the ones that bleed. They say this is different than the past. I view the military as a vicious dog that you hold on a leash. When you want the dog to attack, you let the dog go. You let the dog do its job, and then you pull it back on the leash. You do not politicize it to the point of where the dog can almost reach its objective and then stop it. How many times do we have to make this same mistake? People say this is different than the Vietnam War, and I say baloney. We were in a no-win situation just like we put these kids in. Who's the good Sunni? Who's the bad Sunni? We don't know. We had a situation of who was the farmer, who was the VC. We didn't know. But I will say one thing. Once we left, it made no difference in Southeast Asia, as it probably won't in the Middle East. There was bloodshed. Cambodia, next door to Vietnam, 2 million people died from the Khmer Rouge. Laos, thousands of people died. The North invaded the South. That was 16 years, after 16 years of American presence. So we seem to repeat history. We now have a situation of where we have 4 years in here where we should have been in and out in two. If it takes 4 years for the Iraqi army to protect itself and they still haven't gotten it or learned it, then we have a real serious problem. But there's one thing that I think has not been brought up, and it has been superficially. One of my colleagues on this floor said, it doesn't matter about morale. That's not true. Do you realize what it's like to be in a war zone, not knowing who the good and the bad is, and yet having people protest against not only your presence, but you doing your job? That's demoralizing. That is bad for your morale. No one can tell me any different, because I've been there and I've done that. I shall, and I did vote to bring this to the floor for discussion, which this has been a healthy discussion, but I shall not support this, and I'll tell you why. I will not, at any time, undermine the morale of our troops, because that's the people that count the most here. I shall honor our vets, because they are the best of the best. I shall use my vote to put a president in that will get us out. And people say, this is illegal what President Bush has done. Well, let's go back in history and think about Truman in Korea. Johnson in Vietnam, another Bush in another war. It may be illegal, but we've certainly done it. Now we put these kids in a no-win situation. I strongly suggest you protest, we all protest, with our use of the ballot next time we have elections. Thank you.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the memorial.
To the memorial.
I was determined not to speak out today, and what changed my mind was hearing the good gentleman from rural Deschutes County told the names of the dead, for which I feel a real sense of responsibility. It took me back to a night. It was a warm summer night, and I visited the Vietnam Memorial for the first time. And I walked down along that black monument, looking at the names of more than 50,000 Americans that died in Vietnam. And as I did it, I said to myself, to what extent am I responsible for these deaths? I'm an average citizen. What role did I play in facilitating the deaths of more than 50,000 Americans? It took me back to a day in Ann Arbor. I think it was May of 1964, when I was a student, and we had just got a news report that a North Vietnam gunship had attacked an American naval vessel. And I had a conversation with a fellow student, a kind of left-wing fellow student, and I remembered saying, America can't stand that kind of attack on its integrity, on its nationhood. And we have to fight back with all the might
we can fight back. And my friend said, you know, I'll bet this whole thing is a fake. I'll bet not only we don't have to fight back because a Boston whaler attacked a cruiser, but I bet it didn't even happen. And I said, oh, this is an American president who says it's happened. A good Democratic American president who says this happened. It must have happened. And if it happened, we have to do everything possible to avenge that attack on America. And I strongly supported the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that passed with only one negative vote, as I remember, in the Senate. Supporting the movement that ultimately led to more than 50,000 American deaths. And it took me a while before I decided this war isn't right. This war isn't getting anywhere. And I need to stand up and use whatever pulpit I can find to speak against it. And the ultimate memory of Vietnam is that helicopter gathering those last people off of the embassy with lots of other people trying to scramble onto that helicopter to get out of Vietnam. Because we had lost patience with the war. We did see we weren't going to win that war. We weren't going to win that war if we fought another 100 years. And we had no business being in that war in the first place. Now, I think I've heard today, while we're not supposed to impugn the motives, I think because my name is on this resolution, I've heard myself referred to as a sunshine patriot. I think I've heard myself referred to as giving aid and comfort to the enemy. I think I've heard myself as being referred to as not supporting our troops in the line of duty. Well, I do need to tell you, I do feel responsible for the names that the good member from rural Deschutes County read. And now I have a different role. I'm in a public body, and I have a responsibility to speak up and say, as I have from the beginning of this war, we have no business in this war. If we want to support American troops, train them, equip them properly, and don't send them to war to find weapons of mass destruction that aren't there. Don't send them to war to find members of terrorist groups that aren't there and that we had every reason to believe weren't there at the time of this war. I say we need to call for our troops to come home. We need to support our troops, and we need to stand up and accept our responsibility for the deaths of those men and women that the good representative from rural Deschutes County read to us today. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I will be brief.
To the memorial?
Yeah, to the memorial. Maybe young people might not remember, but as an older member of this body, I do remember well when U.S. was making the resolution in the Congress, the resolution of the Tonkin, that the involving to Vietnam War, that the two U.S. senators opposed that resolution. Do you remember that's one of the Wayne Moss from our state, and the other one was from the Alaska, if my remembrance is correct. And I thought at the time that our senator, even though I was not a citizen at the time, was not writing for him to vote against that. But his story proven that he was right. And then, as he already discussed it, we lost more than 50,000 young men in Vietnam. And then I respect them fighting for the freedom against the communism, against the aggression, any communism around the world. And then fought back. But to me, history tells me that was not the right war for us. 911. We all know that when airplane hit the Twin Tower, and more than 3,000 people were perished in the 911 attack. And then, did you see that in Baghdad and the capital city of the Iraq, they danced? I'm sure you remember that. And then, as a human being, and as a student of the of this great country, and somehow I attached to the American country, and then personally I resented that. I'm sure, I don't know how you feel it, but their government didn't stop that. People in the street danced as we suffered it, and then you know, as a human being, as a man of emotion, naturally I resented it, and somehow we need to punish them. You know, I feel that way. Okay. When 2003 Iraq War began, I fully supported it as a person and as a country. While they are continually refusing the 17 resolutions from UN, and then believed to be they have weapons of mass destruction, and plus many other reasons, and somehow I thought I was justified. We all justified, most of the people of America, going into Iraq. And I wholeheartedly supported it. But maybe if this resolution pardon me, were the last year, maybe I could have voted against on this resolution. But at this time, I'm standing in support of this HJM-9. I need to explain why I'm voting for this bill, for this memorial. It is known that we cannot win this war unless we all go out 100% all we have to destroy the country, then we can win. But this terrorist, this Al-Qaeda, is among the people. To kill one person, we have to kill 10 hundreds of the innocent civilians. It is very difficult for us to do that. So militarily, we are not going to win. Many generals already testified that. This is we are in the middle of a religious war. You may not know this, but that already World War III began in a quiet way. We didn't know that, but I detected that. It slowly began World War. This will lead into a bigger war sometime in the future. I don't know when, but I know this will be. Okay, I was going to make a short, somehow getting longer. This is also a cultural war.
Representative Barker yields.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Barker. This is also a cultural war. This is also a sectarian conflict among themselves. We have no business to be in the middle of this culture and the religious and then plus many other things. We've been there already 4 years. Korean War ended 1 year and 1 month. World War II ended about 5 years. And then we already going into a fifth year of conflict. I don't see any clear sight we are going to win. I believe it's time to come home. You know, I want you to know, not supporting this bill, I don't want anyone to translate that we are not supporting the truth. We are not that is supporting fighting against the world terrorism. It is not. It is opposite. Because I love the country, because I love the soldiers, because I love the freedom, and because of the same reason, I'm supporting of this resolution. You know, day one, our country will be weakened. continually putting our resources of manpower and the money and everything we have into the one country or two, and then our country, when we are weakened, all the countries will rise up against our country. And then we cannot do that. We need to bring our soldiers back in a timely manner, in a gradual manner, and we need to bring back our country strong. When American country strong, then world at peace. When we are weakened, we are going to see more conflict around the world. Sometimes we like we are tamed lion, and we just cannot allow that. So I guess that's about it. And out of that already mentioned, you know, this is a very difficult vote for me. But you cannot get any more good Republican like I am in our country. I'm a good Republican, and I value Republican value. You know, I strongly support the president, but not on this resolution. It's time to bring our soldiers back home. And as long as we are doing fighting for them, they are not going to fight. You know, next year are they going to fight their own war? They are not. As long as we are fighting for them, and responsibility is theirs, not ours. We have done our job. It's time to come home. Thank you, Mr. President.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the memorial.
To the memorial.
I will be brief. Colleagues, let me start by declaring an inherited bias. My family has a long history of military service, fighting for freedom, fighting for liberty and democracy. Starting with my great-great-great-granddad, I was just a great, two greats. He served in the Civil War, and he survived the infamous Andersonville prison. And I have three great uncles who all served in the armed forces. My dad and my Uncle Bob all served in Vietnam. My cousin Joshua, he's in the Air Force. He just returned from Iraq. I'm extremely grateful for their service. Thank you. And for what they've done to make this country great. I stand here with a sad heart. Sad heart thinking that HJM 9 somehow is a slap in the face to their struggles and their sacrifices. This morning I introduced you to a wonderful lady from Kaiser, mother of a hero. She knows the meaning of sacrifice. She lost her son 2 months ago today. When an IED blew up his Humvee in Baghdad when he was on patrol. Got plenty, thanks. Shauna Hill was brave enough to come before the House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee and tell Ryan's story. She read a letter to me that came from Brian last fall. Well, she read a letter at the committee. It came to her from Ryan last fall, talking about his best friends being killed by a sniper. Part of the letter said, "Some of us won't make it back from this place, and we shall never forget them. The rest of us who are here will keep fighting for you and those you love." Shauna's testimony to our committee ended like this. She said, instead of opposing reinforcements and asking for a troop withdrawal, You should demand that the President and Congress be of one mind toward one goal, victory. Demand that they stop playing political games with our soldiers' lives and demand that the war be fought as if our lives depend on it. Because, like Ryan, I believe that our lives do depend on their success. I sat through hours of testimony in that committee, and some of it's very emotional. I've read dozens of emails from people all over the state, and let me just give you a couple of compelling samples. Rendy Noling from North Portland. She was married 26 years to an Oregon National Guard soldier who'd spent the past 3 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. She works with other Guard families, and she says they are fighting so the next generation will not have to finish what they started. Let them finish. They are the true heroes. I ask that you honor them by not passing the measure. From Paula Lewitz of Portland, urging a no vote on HGM 9, she said, this is not about agreeing or disagreeing with this war. It is about protecting our troops, no matter what our position on the war. And I'll wrap up with the words of another constituent who has amazingly sat through all this, and he's up in the gallery, and I introduced him early. Bill Coffey, he'd served in the National Guard and has done a couple of tours in Middle East. He said it's a very nice soundbite to say you support the troops but don't support the mission. That is like saying you support law enforcement but don't want them enforcing the law. In a world of fantasy and make-believe, HGM makes sense, but we live in the real world. We must ask ourselves two things. Does it help us achieve victory? Does it make our enemies afraid to attack us again?
Representative Gilliam yields.
Thank you, Representative. The answer to both is no. HGM 9 says nothing about victory, nothing about success. It says we give up. Colleagues, the words of those who have served do speak volumes. And it is my fear that we will send the wrong message with our words, with our approval of House Joint Memorial 9. Please don't undermine the morale of our troops who are there fighting for democracy, fighting so we have a right to live in a free country, fighting for the right for us to stand on the floor of the Oregon State House of Representatives and debate openly. Please vote against House Joint Memorial 9 and send a strong message that we care and we want our troops to succeed, that we want victory. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative David Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the memorial.
To the memorial.
My interest in this memorial is not so much personal as a matter of principle. I believe patriotism, enlightened patriotism, compels us to address any and all matters that threaten our social covenant. Our social covenant, like the prophetic covenant made at Sinai through Moses, mandates that together we are responsible for the character of our country. The principal costs to our state have already been counted by previous speakers. The number of Oregonians dead and injured, the reduced capacity of our National Guard as we enter the fire season, the lack of personnel and equipment to handle emergencies, the economic stress placed on families and small businesses. I submit that this dreadful balance sheet fails to convey the war's true price. No, the true price is captured in lives unseen and everyday heartbreaks that escape our notice. A telling incident in my district, in my hometown, shows that veterans who want to help the most are often the ones who are hurt the worst. In mid-2003, second-generation soldier Sergeant William Stout left his Oregon National Guard Air Ambulance Unit to voluntarily join ground troops in Iraq. In July of 2004, Sergeant Stout was injured rescuing a fellow officer during an attack outside Taji. Lifting the officer out of a downed Humvee had compressed two discs in his back, chipped his vertebrae, and cracked his pelvis. doctors said that returning to duty would cause a paralyzing injury. Coming home to Hillsboro, Sergeant Stout soon showed all the markers of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, excessive drinking. His diary entries from these days reveal his state of mind. One entry reads, in part, "I have experienced honor, bravery, courage, how to stand in combat, fight back standing, and save my wounding brothers. I am proud of every Marine and Oregon National Guardsman I've known. I used to feel normal. Since I've been to Iraq and seen and done the things I did, PTSD has taken control of me. I can't be happy anymore. I haven't slept for months. My stomach is always upset. No matter how hard I've tried, nothing goes right with my family. I can't put it together." In July of 2005, Sergeant Stout forced a confrontation with local police. His plan was to end his life. Fortunately for the sergeant and his family, he ultimately surrendered to police without incident. And now, after regular counseling with his wife, is learning to live with post-traumatic stress disorder. He has rejoined the workforce and was recently nominated for the Bronze Star for Valor. Sergeant Stout's story is only one of many similar stories around our state. Almost one-third of U.S. soldiers seeking government health care after returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, with the highest rates among National Guard troops. That compares to a rate of only 10% among Vietnam War veterans. One way or another, our troops will bring the war back home. So I say to you, it is our collective responsibility to ensure they receive everything they need to be made whole, and to do what we can to curtail the number who will suffer the after effects of this conflict for the rest of their days. In anticipating his planned confrontation with police, Sergeant Stout had written in his diary, "I want no one hurt, no demands." Then he changed his mind. "I want the soldiers to come home," he wrote. This sentiment, coming from a man whose life had been framed by his duties to God and country, demands our fixed attention. It is a heartfelt plea to match our purpose to our power, to redefine our notion of patriotism beyond simple military pride. So I call on the courageous in spirit, regardless of party, to show the world what a truly free people can do, and in voting for this memorial, move our state, our country, and the world closer to the natural principles of the heart. Let us repair our social covenant. Let us bring our troops home to the love and honors they deserve for their willing sacrifices. As rendered so eloquently in America the Beautiful, "God, mend thine every flaw, confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law." With that, my colleagues, I urge your aye vote on this memorial.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Shields, do you wish to close?
I do, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. Colleagues, before I close, I think it's important that I address a couple of the arguments that I've heard today on this floor. Regarding the argument that we should just keep pushing forward with the escalation, I'd say that General Petraeus, the top new military commander in Iraq, said that the truth surge has only a 1 in 4 chance of succeeding. 1 in 4. Now today, the administration says there's evidence that the surge, the escalation, is working. I hope they're right. I pray that they're right. For 4 years, I've prayed that they would be right. But colleagues, this is the same people who told us in May 2005 that the insurgency was in its last throes. This is the same people who told us in March 2003, almost 4 years ago to this day, that we'd be greeted as liberators, who said that the capture of Saddam Hussein was the turning point, who said the first election was clearly the turning point, who said the second election was clearly the turning point, who said the third election was clearly the turning point. Or to turn a phrase from another time, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. Now, colleagues, I would love to take the President at his word. The reality is that since this escalation began just a few weeks ago, 73 troops had been killed. And March is on track to be as deadly as the record-setting months of January and February before it. I'm pained to announce that just on Sunday, the U.S. military announced the deaths of 7 more troops in Iraq, including 4 killed by a roadside bomb while patrolling western Baghdad. And it's now coming to light that 21,000 troops is just the beginning of this escalation. On March 10th, the president said he wanted an additional 4,600 troops. On Friday, he said he wants an additional 3,000 more on top of that, 4,600. So 7,600 total more troops, mostly those who are facing redeployment for the second, third, or fourth time, or had their training or convalescent time cut short. The Boston Globe said that even supporters of the escalation, like the resident scholar at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, who actually came up with the plan for escalation, has recently criticized the Bush administration, saying it should have been more straightforward about how many troops the strategy might require. Colleagues, I'm afraid my patience for these shades of the truth and rosy assessments has simply run too thin. And colleagues, for those of you who say that we have no right to make this statement, I say to you this: the President of the United States works for us. We don't work for the President of the United States. It is right for us today to send a strong message, a message that the majority of Oregonians believe, that our troops have done their job and it's time to bring the troops home. Regarding the argument that this sends the wrong message, our troops carry out policy, they don't create it, they do it with honor, they do it with valor, and they depend on their elected officials to act as checks and balances and to stand up for them. So, what do the troops think? In January, a poll of active military conducted by Military Times found this. It revealed that the majority of the active duty troops polled disapproved of the president's conduct of the war, and nearly 60% said the civilian leadership at the Pentagon did not have their best interests at heart. They don't trust the civilian leadership at the Pentagon. That's what the troops think. Now, Representative Holvey asked me to say that not supporting the troops, or that supporting the troops is not putting them in positions where you're putting targets on their back with no plan for victory. So, colleagues, I don't care if you are Republican or Democrat. Today we need to stand up for our troops and their families, because our troops can't do it for themselves. They depend on their elected officials to stand up for them. So to close, colleagues, this is our moment, our time, right here, right now, on this floor. This isn't about President Bush. It's about doing right by our troops. It's about doing right by their families. The troops do their jobs. They serve this great country without question, without politics. They depend on us as elected officials to stand up for them. And to say that they cannot be expected to shed their blood for Iraq's security forever. And we're saying that the Oregon Homeward Bound Act of 2007 is a way to bring our troops home. So before you vote, if you're on the fence, please, just for a moment, think about this historical moment. Because today you have the chance to throw down your marker in history. You have the chance to tell your kids, your grandkids, that we were here, standing up for our troops, standing up for their families, and sending a strong bipartisan message to Congress and the President that our troops have done their job and it's time to bring the troops home. This is definitely an Oregon issue. That's why over 44 people testified, pleaded with this body to support House Joint Memorial 9. Supporters of HJM 9, like Steve Weiss, whose son is scheduled to leave for Baghdad in April. Supporters like Elijah Smith, a former Marine who served in Iraq, who said, quote, "A phased withdrawal is not giving up without completing the job. Instead," he said, "it is my opinion that the job cannot be completed until withdrawal begins." because the continued presence of the American military is undermining the legitimacy of the Iraqi government. Our presence, he said, is making things worse. Supporters, like the parents of David W. Johnson, who I believe was the friend or mother of the person who yelled down from the galley, who was killed in Iraq, in proud service to state, in proud service to country, while serving in the Oregon Army National Guard. In committee, David's mom bowed her head as her husband Steve spoke of their son. And colleagues, David's father said this. He said, "If our son could speak to you today, if our son could speak to you today, he would tell you, bring my buddies home." Let's bring David's buddies home. Vote yes on House Joint Memorial number 9. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I respectfully request a call of the House.
Representative Shields requests a call of the House. He is joined in that by Representative Berger, Representative Greenlick, Representative Cowan, Representative Dallum, and Representative Esquivel. The doorkeepers will bar the doors. Sergeant-at-Arms will attend, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker. Barnhart. Berger. Beyer. Bonamici. Boone. Boquist. Bruin. Buckley. Burley. Butler. Cameron. Cannon. Clem. Cowan. Dallum. Dingfelder. Dingfelder Chris Edwards. David Edwards. Esquivel. Flores. Galizio. Garrard. Gelzer. Gilliam. Gilman. Gerard. Greenlick. Hannah. Holvey. Hunt. Jensen. Comp. Kotek. Krieger. Crummel. Lim. McPherson. Maurer. Minnis. Morgan. Nathanson. Nelson. Nolan. Olson. Reed. Richardson. Riley. Roblin. Rosenbaum. Rosenbaum Schaffler. Scott. Shields. Greg Smith. Patty Smith. Thatcher. Tomei. Wisnet. Witt. Mr. Speaker. Not answering. Dingfelder. Excused. Boone. Minnis.
All members are present. I'll remind my colleagues on the floor, and I'll remind the public in the gallery that any outbursts or commentary following the vote are inappropriate and need to be taken outside the chamber. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. House Joint Memorial 9A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Propositions and motions. Representative Cameron, for what purpose do you rise?
Request to return to courtesies.
Representative Cameron, request unanimous consent to return to courtesies without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, today I have an intern with me that got to observe our nice debate on the floor. Caitlin Hendricks is going to be leaving us. She's been with us this whole term. She's from Lynn Benton Community College. She's a sophomore and has an internship lined up back in Washington, D.C. this summer, and then will finish her education at a university to be determined on the East Coast of the United States of America. Caitlin, thank you very much for your support.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. They may no longer be here, but I would like to ask that courtesies be extended to the volunteers from the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, and the American Lung Association of Oregon. These volunteers are here today from all over Oregon to advocate for effective tobacco control for our state. Thank you.
Further courtesies? Propositions and motions? First reading of House bills. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 2080 relating to extending the deadline for returning ballots and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2092 relating to delegation of parental powers by a parent in active military service. House Bill 2107 relating to construction contractor obligations. House Bill 2154 relating to sexual assault victims and emergency medical response funding declaring an emergency. House Bill 2213 relating to payments for procedures covered by health benefit plan. House Bill 2635 relating to family leave. House Bill 2729 relating to Oregon Student Assistance Commission appropriated money declaring an emergency. House Bill 343 relating to forests.
Bills read a second time or pass the third reading. Consent calendar. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended, that bills remaining on today's consent calendar be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, March 21st, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Third reading of House bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended, that the bills remaining on today's third reading of House bills be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, March 21st, 2007, third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Third reading of Senate bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. Final reading, memorials and resolutions. Chair requests unanimous consent that rules be suspended, that the measure remaining on today's final reading, memorials and resolutions, be carried over to its proper place on Wednesday, March 21st, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business line on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 5502 relating to Financial Administration of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services appropriate money and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 5514 relating to Financial Administration of the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries appropriate money and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 5524 relating to Financial Administration of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 5532 relating to Financial Administration of the State Board of Pharmacy and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 66 relating to Administration of Public Funds appropriate money and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 103 relating to Hazardous Waste Generation. Senate Bill 105 relating to oil spills and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 106 relating to heating oil tanks and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 112 relating to subpoenas and criminal action. Senate Bill 131 relating to restitution. Senate Bill 145 relating to division program for licenses of board medical examiners. Senate Bill 188 relating to rural health service program. Senate Bill 195 relating to employment that ends individual disqualification from receipt of unemployment benefits. Senate Bill 206 relating to regulation of naturopathic medicine. Senate Bill 209 relating to qualifications for members of council on naturopathic physicians formula. Senate Bill 219 relating to confidential information secured by employment department. Senate Bill 222 relating to motor carriers and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 322 relating to judgment. Senate Bill 501 relating to judgment. Senate Bill 537 relating to dresses on Department of Transportation records. Senate Bill 553 relating to sentencing guidelines. Senate Bill 579 relating to Oregon growth accounts. Senate Bill 620 relating to naturopathic physicians.
Bills read first time or passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 155 relating to mental health treatment and declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 400 relating to employment relations and public collective bargaining.
Bills read second time or passed the third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended, that bills remain in today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over their proper place on the Wednesday, March 21st, 2007, third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House? Other business of the Senate? Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Republicans' caucus at 1 will be canceled. We will have a caucus at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Representative Hunt.
Due to the late hour, Democrats will not caucus today.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee on Revenue will meet promptly at 1:30.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Veterans Committee, due to the lateness of the day, is canceled for today.
Representative Comp.
House Education Subcommittee will meet at 1:45.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. Government Accountability and Information Technology will meet at 1:30.
Are there further announcements? Remonstrances? Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 10:30 a.m., Wednesday, March 21st, 2007.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 10:30 a.m. Wednesday,
March 21st, 2007.
Representative Jensen moves that the House adjourn until 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 21st, 2007. Without objection, the House is adjourned.